To order. Good morning, all. Today we're going to be hearing from several groups, three in fact, Minnesota State Universities and Colleges, MNSCU, Department of Administration, and a little bit on the zoologic garden. So to start, why don't we, maybe I should mention one thing. There's going to be some PowerPoints shown here, and they will be available afterwards. They may be available, frankly, right now on the Senate Capital Investment website should you want to refer back to them for any reason at any time. So they'll be part of the committee history on that website. With that, welcome Chancellor Rosenstone, and your guest, is it Brian Yolitz or close?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Brian Yolitz. Thank you.
Yolitz, okay. Welcome, and you may begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Senjum, members of the committee. It's a great pleasure to be with you this morning to discuss the investment priorities for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Our goal is to provide both the details of the capital projects, but also to try to provide a broader context for why they're so important. In addition to our presentation, which Chair Senjum's already mentioned, we've provided for you a copy of our bonding book, as well as a handout detailing the execution plan associated with each of the projects. Brian Yolitz is our Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities. He leads both the capital investment prioritization project process as well as the implementation of our capital projects. Brian joined us just a little over a year ago after 27 years of service in the United States Air Force, responsibilities for logistics and facilities management, and we welcome that expertise and his role in Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Also joined today by one of our presidents, President Sue Hammersmith from Metropolitan State University. Our investments are focused on the infrastructure needed to advance Minnesota's workforce, both to improve today's learning spaces and support the growing need for scientists, health professionals, engineers, precision machinists, technologists, and other workers in short supply. Our request falls into two main areas. First, essential repairs to protect our workforce training areas, keeping them safe, efficient, dry, warm, and code compliant. And second, workforce skills gap-driven projects to provide the necessary facilities that are needed to deliver to business and industry graduates with the skills needed to meet both current and future needs. Many of you have visited our campuses, and I very much appreciate the time you have spent to observe and understand our projects firsthand. It's a huge investment of time and energy, and I am grateful. Preparing Minnesota's workforce with the job skills required by business and industry is our core mission. It is the core mission of our 31 colleges and universities, who themselves are an integral part of the economic vitality of 47 communities across the state, not just providing access to higher education, but providing the training necessary for the businesses and industries in the regional economies of Minnesota to thrive. Our 850 buildings, nearly 27 million square feet, represent roughly one-third of all the state of Minnesota's facilities. That's where the teaching and learning and job training happens in Minnesota. Over the past decade, there's been a surge in enrollments, up 15%, and investments in facilities needs to keep pace with serving the increasing number of students that come to our colleges and universities. Today, we educate more than 420,000 students across the entire state. 80% of our graduates stay right here in Minnesota to either continue their education or begin work, and 85% of our graduates who begin work in their chosen field right after they receive their certificate or degree. We partner with about 6,000 employers across the state to ensure that we can provide customized training to meet the needs of about 120,000 employees each year to keep those employees and those firms competitive. and we prudently manage our operations. Over the past 10 years, the real cost of providing an education to a Minsk U student is actually down 10%. Now, of course, who's paying that cost has shifted as the state has reduced its support and more of the burden has fallen to our students. But the actual cost of delivering that education in constant dollars is down 10%. Productivity in the use of our square footage, credit hours per square foot, is up 20%. Faculty productivity up 12%. And if you look at the cost of maintaining and running our system versus other systems around the country, we're at number 37 on the list out of 50, and that's one of those lists you don't want to be near the top. You want to be near the bottom, as we are. We are the place that working adults go to complete certificates, two-year and four-year degrees and graduate programs. We're the place that displaced workers go when it's time to retool and prepare for new careers. We're the place where businesses large and small go when they need training for their employees or need help solving real-world problems. And we are uniquely positioned to help grow the state's economy, and that's why investment in workforce training facilities is so crucial to Minnesota's prosperity. Today, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities serve 60% of all the undergraduates in the state of Minnesota, with the remaining 40% divided between the University of Minnesota, the private colleges, the for-profit colleges. We cover 60%. Each project before you has gone through a very rigorous prioritization process, and we are presenting in this year's request our most urgent needs, which represent roughly one-third of the nearly $900 million in total investment we've mapped out for the years ahead. One final point before I turn it over to Brian to get into some of the specifics. This slide shows the status of our implementation of the projects that you approved last year. Bottom line, we are very effective in our execution of projects. Implementation is quick, immediately putting people to work, creating jobs for thousands of Minnesotans in communities across our state. The $30 million for HEPR has been deployed to our campuses. We're on track to have 90% of all the funds encumbered by the end of this March. The additional $102 million, which funded seven major capital projects that all address workforce and skills gap needs of businesses and industry, are under contract with five already in the ground and two deep in the design process. Put differently, we are 100% on track with the funds that you allocated last year. With this general background, let me turn the presentation over to Brian, who will walk us through the specific details of our request.
Before that, are there any questions of the Chancellor? Chancellor, I just have one. Yesterday was a day, at least for legislators, when we saw firsthand how populations have shifted in Minnesota and how legislative districts have moved, and they've tended to move towards regional centers, I suppose. I've not really analyzed it in detail, but I think we can see the shift where rural areas get larger because of smaller populations and obviously, people are migrating towards larger settings, whatever it might be, urban centers or even urban areas, regional centers or urban areas. When you look at your enrollments and they're up 15%, do you see your enrollment shifting in that direction, or is it still pretty broad across the state? And if you don't have any idea, that's fine too. It's kind of
members of the committee do have an idea. Indeed, the enrollment shifts parallel very much the kind of shifts we saw yesterday in the redrawing of legislative districts. The total request before you is space neutral, but it does respond to the growing demand, particularly in the metro area, for new facilities to meet the 20 and 30% enrollment increases that have occurred in recent years in many of our colleges. It's space neutral because at the same time that we're increasing our footprint in areas where the student demand has way outgrown the available space, we're also recognizing that in parts of the state where facilities are obsolete, can't be refurbished, and are no longer needed to serve students, it's time to take them offline to ensure the efficiency of that campus and the efficiency of the system. So very much parallel to what we saw yesterday, there are population shifts in our enrollment demands, and our bonding request is cognizant of those shifts and cognizant of where the increased need for students to be served needs to be met.
Thank you. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a kind of a different question. Most of the time, most of the time we have a very thorough planning process that projects go through, and it's a somewhat of a time-consuming process. What this is for projects I guess if you go back a number of years, many of the projects would be lobbied, I suppose you could say, from local campuses, and most of that's pretty well disappeared. And I think for the most part that's a very good, it's a very thoughtful process that you have. But what, in the case of projects that come in or change very quickly to adjust for a given need, where, let's say, an industry or a segment has shifted or developed, how do you respond to that when this process has taken, let's say, maybe years to put in place, and you have your system or your categories and your systems developed? How does the Minsky system react to those types of changes so that they can be on top of things?
Chancellor?
Chair Senjum, Senator Stump, we have an example of that this summer where the system saw the need to move in a different direction, move more rapidly because of actions actually that the legislature took last year on a project. We brought a proposal to the board to revise the rankings, to revise the projects that we're bringing forward to you to respond very quickly to that need. It was something that the president of that university in this case brought to our attention as a possibility. We did the analysis and saw that indeed it was the right way to go. So we're always in a position to reconsider what it is we're recommending, bring it to our board for review and approval, and then forward it on to you. And my door remains open to presidents or ideas where we need to be moving with great agility.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the
Senator
project
Stump.
That I was thinking of is the one in Thief River Falls, mm-hmm. the UAV project. I'm not sure if members are all aware of it, but I think I'll have the opportunity, I hope anyway, to present the project here. And it was it's a field, the unmanned vehicle field that has developed rather quickly in response to the military usage, and now it's being commercialized quite quickly. And so we have one of the campuses that has a kind of on the cutting edge development.
Yeah, like music
that,
fire protection.
Chancellor.
Senator Senjum, Senator Stump, I'm very much aware of that. I visited that campus even before officially being signed in as chancellor in August. We were there in July. It is a very exciting opportunity. We don't want to move faster than the project is ready to move, and I have not received a request from that president to reconsider the proposal that we've brought forward to the board or to bring forward to this legislature. I think, as you noted, we have a pretty thorough process for vetting and prioritizing requests from all of our campuses, and we try to take all the considerations and all the industrial needs that are there in the state of Minnesota into account when we create such a list. No such request was made of me or the board to reconsider and bring you a different ranking than the one you received.
Mr. Yelich?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Committee, it's good to be with you this morning. In support of our capital improvement program, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities requests $222.5 million in state funding to be combined with $56.2 million from state, system funds to execute a $278.7 million program supporting Minnesota's workforce training and development for 2012. This is the system's smallest request since fiscal year 2000. The capital program is made up of three elements. First is $110 million for heaper needs, focused on essential repairs and renewal of existing facility space, directly supporting workforce programs across the system. $157.1 million funds 22 major capital projects at 21 college and university campuses within our system. 14 of the 22 projects being presented have been presented in prior capital requests to the legislature, but ultimately were not funded. In addition, $11.6 million would fund three system initiatives where we've bundled smaller projects from multiple campuses that focus on workforce areas in the area of STEM, energy, and classrooms. Within these three initiatives are 21 projects at 14 campuses within the system. All of our projects are shovel-ready. We define shovel-ready as being poised and ready to move to the next phase of design or construction. The colored bar chart that you have in your packages as a part of a handout shows you the execution strategy of our request. Projects are listed in priority order as approved by our Board of Trustees. The colored hash marks correspond to the various design and construction phases each project must go through to deliver upon our request. The green and red elements highlight the design phases of A&E selection, schematic design, design development, and construction documents preparation. The yellow and blue elements show bid and award periods, the actual construction period, as well as the final punch list and project closeout. The HEPR request of $110 million funds nearly 135 projects at executing multiple contracts at 53 campuses within the system. It reflects our Board of Trustees' number one capital requirement. Over 95% of these investments is in existing facility infrastructure repairs, in the renewal and preservation of our facilities, and on aging systems within those facilities, making them more efficient and more effective, and reducing our operating expenses for our campuses. The balance addresses code and standard compliance issues and accomplishes advanced design of some of our more complex future needs. The HEPR portion of our request is critical to our campuses. And it's important to recognize our investments in HEPR are as much about the systems or the buildings and the project titles as it is about the project the workforce training and learning spaces they service and protect. HEPR is about protecting and sustaining workforce training capacity for Minnesota. To underscore this point, here are three examples of the many HEPR requirements we seek to address in this session. At St. Cloud Technical and Community College, $1.4 million replaces three nearly 50-year-old boilers with five smaller high-efficiency boilers servicing the 380,000-square-foot main building, housing workforce programs including carpentry, auto body, diesel mechanics, electrical plumbing, and HVAC, and metals programs, as well as their transfer programs at the campus there. These will make the campus more operationally efficient. In fact, we have advanced funding when fiscal year 2011 to make sure this project was ready to execute as early as June of this year. In North Mankato, our South Central College campus, $2 million replaces 90,000 square feet of roofing, which is leaking over and negatively impacting science, math, English, chemistry, biology classrooms, and labs at that campus. Finally, at Rochester Community and Technical College, $3.2 million would replace major portions of their 40-year-old electrical distribution system, servicing 300,000 square feet of their main campus area in the areas housing their workforce classrooms, STEM, allied health, and technical lab spaces. We started this work with a small amount of funds from fiscal year 11 and replaced several failed transformers, but we have a long ways to go. Each project in our plan has a story just like these. HEPR is about protecting and sustaining workforce training capacity for Minnesota. Just as our HEPR work is focused on protecting and sustaining workforce training spaces, our 22 line item major capital projects and three system initiatives are focused on supporting the workforce needs of Minnesota. You'll find in your bonding books that we've provided in your packages a total request as prioritized by our Board of Trustees, as well as more details about HEPR and individual projects. The requested projects focus on state's workforce needs, and we've highlighted those workforce needs in individual project descriptions in your bonding booklets. From a big picture perspective, we've organized these projects into four major areas impacting the workforce. Minnesota needs more scientists and engineers. They need the learning spaces to prepare students on the 21st century technologies they'll see in the workplace upon graduation. While all of our capital projects impact many workforce areas, these projects in Marshall, Bemidji, White Bear Lake, and Matamidi, Inver Grove Heights, Moorhead, Hibbing, Itasca, Eveleth, Pine City, and St. Paul are primarily focused on the STEM needs of the workforce. The demand for allied health for nurses, medical technicians, pharmacists, dental hygienists, radiologists, and respiratory therapists continues to grow. DEED sees a 22% increase in jobs in these areas over the period 2009 to 2019. Our students need facilities that replicate the work environments in which they'll serve Minnesotans. Mock surgery suites, intensive care units, and simulation labs do just that. These projects at our college and university campuses in Faribault, Coon Rapids, Brooklyn Park, St. Paul, and Mankato are focused on the allied health needs of Minnesota, as well as improving on workforce training areas at the campuses. The technical training, including agriculture, construction, energy, manufacturing, and machining, are critical components of our economy. DEED projects the transportation business, truck drivers, heavy equipment operators, mechanics, and repair technicians to grow by more than 2,000 jobs annually through 2019. Projects in Minneapolis, Willmar, Rosemount, Staples, Anoka, White Bear Lake, Matamidi, Jackson, Hibbing, Itasca, Moorhead, St. Cloud directly impact the technical trade spaces at these campuses and support these communities, as well as complement and prepare workforce needs at these campuses. Finally, it is critical to provide quality classrooms to meet the basic educational capacity needs. These spaces provide the foundation for all higher education. Foundational courses like math and writing prepare students for all fields. These courses also prepare students for transfer programs to advanced studies and in support of four-year baccalaureate studies in education, leadership and management, business, accounting, marketing, economics, and much, much more. In addition, these spaces are where our regional partners come for customized training. These projects in Worthington, White Bear Lake, Matamidi, Rochester, Bemidji, Grand Rapids, Albert Lea, Inver Grove Heights, St. Paul, Winona, and Alexandria improve classrooms and provide quality learning spaces for all of our students. Executing these capital requests will have a profound impact on our ability to prepare graduates to meet the most pressing workforce needs facing Minnesota. In summary, our investment are focused on infrastructure necessary to prepare Minnesota's workforce. Our $278.7 million capital program again seeks $222.5 million in state financing to be matched with $56.2 million in system funds to address essential repairs and workforce skills gap projects required to deliver Minnesota graduates with the education and skills required to meet their current and future needs. Each project has been through a rigorous vetting and prioritization process. We are committed to being efficient and effective in the execution of our projects, quickly creating jobs that will put Minnesotans to work in local communities throughout the state. We're ready to answer any additional questions you may have. Thank you for your time and attention this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Yolitz. Are there any questions of either Mr. Yolitz or the Chancellor? Senator Mitzen, and we'll go over here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Yolitz, is there a, I don't see it in the packet, but could we be apprised of the HEPRA list of what are the improvements that are going to be made? You listed three or four, but I just want to know if we could get, the committee can get a list of what's being fixed up.
Senator Mitzen, I think we,
is it?
I think we have it, the document like this.
I thought that that's not the.
Well, maybe I should let the witness answer. Is it not this?
Mr. Chairman, I thought these were probably future projects, but upon it's kind of early in the morning to get, you know, to be up to speed on this stuff. But this is the list here, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Yolitz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Yolitz, indeed.
Yeah, I tell you, you're way ahead of me. But anyway, thank you.
Okay.
And there are, Mr. Chairman, some projects in my district on this list. So.
Okay.
Amazing.
Senator Thomasoni.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. certainly this touches every corner of the state, and it looks like you're doing your best to respond to the workforce needs around the state. But just a curiosity, I've heard both Chancellor Rosenstone and President Taylor talk about the cost of educating a student is 10% less today than it was in 1998, but as a result of lack of state support, tuition has skyrocketed in both institutional settings. And I was just wondering, we have a one-third requirement of the system to throw into the bonding. How much does that drive tuition? I don't know if you know that answer.
We do.
Chancellor?
We have the exact number for you. It's remarkably small, and we can give you the number both for what it's been in all the things that are currently being paid for out of debt service, as well as if this entire program were funded, what the impact would be. If the entire program were funded, the impact on student tuition would be 35 cents per credit hour. So multiply that by 15, and that's how much it would be per semester, 35 cents. The reason is that we split the one-third debt service with the campus, and the rest is handled by the system, with none of that being passed on to the campus. Now, that 35 cents assumes that two-thirds of the entire cost of the debt service that falls to the campus would be paid for out of a tuition increase. In the case of many of our campuses, they've been saving funds over the last 5, 6, 7 years, anticipating a project going forward, and they have the money in the bank to cover the debt service, in which case there would be none of it passed on to the students. But the answer for this program is 35 cents, and I think the answer for everything in the past is, I think, roughly $1.72 per credit of all the things that have been funded over the past years that are still being paid for out of debt service. So quite minimal, I think, is the answer to your question, Senator.
Okay. Senator Nelson, I'll come over.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to take a moment and applaud the Chancellor on the efficiencies that you were able to present to us today. I think that is great news for Minnesota and for our students. So that is not lost. I want to thank you for that. And one of the statistics that really sticks out in my mind is that MinSCU prepare 60% of our state's undergrads, and that the vast majority of them stay here in Minnesota. So that's also a real shining star. As a member of the Governor's Workforce Development Council, that job preparation is very important. And one of the items that has come to attention most recently is this job skills gap, and how painful it is for me to visit with employers who have job openings for 1,000 people, but they can't find the employees. And so closing that job skills gap has got to be one of our top priorities. Which is why I want to ask you about workforce development centers. I see them as a real avenue to help close that job skills gap. And I would just, I hope, if you can't tell me now, maybe you can tell me offline. How many were, and it seems like such a smart thing to marry the workforce development centers with our workforce development universities. And I'm just wondering, how many of those do we have in the state where we have the workforce development center in our MinSCU institutions?
Chancellor.
Chair Senjum, Senator Nelson, terrific and important question. We have seven campuses that have co-located workforce centers. But on every one of our campuses, there's very close communication with the Regional Workforce Center. You're absolutely right. Closing the skills gap is a huge priority for us and a huge priority for the state. Part of the alignment you see here in the request we've brought to you is to help give us the capacity to do precisely that. But it also involves this kind of communication you've suggested with the workforce centers. It involves having a much deeper understanding from business and industry about exactly what skills they need in what professions. And we're going to be partnering with DEED, with the Workforce Centers, with the Governor's Workforce Development Council, with United Way, and with the Chamber of Commerce to have those conversations this spring, region by region, sector by sector, to listen very carefully. We then go back and redesign our academic programs to make sure we're turning out the right graduates in the right places with the right skills to fill the jobs that need to be done in Minnesota. Another part of the puzzle that we're committed to solving is the pipeline. And that means we have to have more students college ready when they leave high school and more students pointed in the right direction to where there are great paying jobs at the end of a certificate or a degree program for them to assume. And we're working carefully with Commissioner Casilius and with Director Pogemiller to think carefully about how we redesign 11, 12, 13, and 14 to get that part of the job done. But the projects before you are completely aligned with exactly the problem that you think we need to solve, and we're completely on board with getting it solved.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, excuse me, just one follow-up. In addition, I just found out last week that our returning veterans are being directed to our workforce development centers as well. So thank you for that.
Chair Senjum, one point, if I might, on that. Well, this year we're serving over 10,000 veterans within our system. There will be a delegation going off to Kuwait, or the next set of veterans coming back. We will be part of that delegation. We have a website where we're working with vets before they return from active duty service to enable them to put their classification in the system, identify what credit they'll get for prior work, what majors it ties to, what jobs it will then tie to. So we're working with those vets even before they come back, and we're preparing to serve the next round coming to Minnesota.
Thank you.
Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, this is wonderful. I appreciate this information, and I was hoping that we could get something like this from the U of M about maybe even going back a little farther about what projects we have funded, where they're in the works, so we can get a comprehensive look at where the dollars have gone. I just have a couple questions, though. Historically, where have we funded? Up to what level of priority list? Is it 12, 14 on the priority list of projects? I thought sometimes we have like a benchmark where we go up to. And then my other question was, Chancellor, Mr. Yolitz, do any of these projects have private dollars involved? Any private contributions, any investment from the private sector?
Senator Senjum,
Mr. Yolitz.
Senator Rosen, we've got some minor investment where some industry will provide some equipment that our students train on, particularly in the manufacturing area. I think of South Central College, where they've engaged with their local manufacturing company there to make sure that students are training on the equipment that they'll see in the workplace. And we've got examples of that. Hospitals do the same kind of thing. So we've got those across the system. I don't have a specific, can't give you exact dollar figure, but we can certainly provide some more details if that would be helpful.
Chancellor, do you have something?
Yes, Senator Senjum. Senator Rosen, there are also projects which are not before you because we've been able to secure private funding to get those projects accomplished. And our first choice is to try to find private support or local support to get a project done before we bring a project to you.
Senator Rosen, I'd
Mr. Chair, on the priority list, this is in pecking order. Is that correct? Priority number one is your first priority. Do we have kind of a game plan of how far we go down on?
Oh, Senator Rosen, and maybe perhaps Senator Langsett might speak as well. But as I recall, last July, I'm not sure we looked at the size of the bill and obviously tried to go as far as we could with it, given all the other projects. And not sure that we said we're going to go down to 10 or 8 or 15 or whatever. It's just a matter of how much money is available. Senator Langs, I don't know if you have thoughts.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just in a more general statement, I think that this is the time to go as far with these types of projects as we possibly can. I think everything they proposed here will be done at some point. Mm-hmm. And shouldn't it be done at a point where it can be done cheaper because the contract's coming in, the bid's coming in lower, and the interest rate at 2.6%. I think, generally speaking, the bonding bill should go somewhat counter to the economy. We should be doing more of it in the downtimes and less of it in the uptimes. I've known times when times are booming, there'll be one bid, and it's so high they have to rebid. When it comes to times like this, there are usually several bids, and they come in low. And, of course, we've got a lot of construction workers sitting on the bench. So this really is the time to do what we're going to have to be doing someday anyway. I think it's somewhat more controversial when it comes to some of these things that some people aren't sure we should be doing or not as a state. But everything that's here will be done. And should we take advantage of the low bids, the low interest rates, and so on? So I think we have to do a lot better than the proposal has come out so far on HEPR. And I think we should go as far down the list as we can, because I have always felt that higher education was the most important part of the bonding bill.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Rosen. I think traditionally we've allocated like 35% to 40% of the bonding bill to higher ed. And the advantage, of course, to investing in higher ed is not only are you putting people to work in the construction projects, but you're making available these facilities to train workers for the future, state-of-the-art facilities, so they're ready to jump right into the workforce. So it's a kind of a double bang for our dollar.
I'm getting the hook here in terms of our time, at least available. Is there any one last burning question? If not, okay, Senator Wicker.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and since we have Mr. Yolitz here as well with the military background, I wanted to ask him regarding the veterans. There was mention earlier about programs, I believe through Governor Plenty's initiative for having the assistance program in each campus with a veteran service officer. There's to be space available as well. Has it been implemented at each campus?
Chancellor?
Chair Senjum, Senator Wicker, yes, we have veteran support on every single campus, veteran centers on every single campus. We're there serving, as I say, nearly 10,000, over 10,000 veterans this year, and linking them up with the right jobs that will ensure their success and helping them through the adjustment struggles that many vets have when they return is part of what we're trying to accomplish, and we're committed to doing so.
Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you, Chancellor and Mr. Yolitz. And let me just say, referring back to page 4, I think it's slide 7, and that $132 million that went out last July. And at this point, it looks like it's essentially out the door. It's the way we like to see bonding projects move quickly and expeditiously and shovels on the ground, so to speak. So thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. Good.
Next, we have Department of Administration, Commissioner Kronk, and Nancy G. Ancola. Is Nancy here?
Well, we'll just get started while this gets loaded. Mr. Chair, members, it's a pleasure to be
Welcome,
here this morning.
Commissioner.
Thank you very much. My remarks will be brief, and then I'll pass it off to Nikki Giancola, our Assistant Commissioner for Facilities Management here at the Department of Administration. It's my pleasure to present the Department of Administration's priorities for a 2012 capital budget request. For decades, the Department of Administration has been strong stewards of capital dollars to preserve our state-owned assets. We recently revised our mission statement over the past 6 months to really focus in on our really priorities in preserving state assets and planning for the future. Our new mission statement reads that we will provide the best value in government administrative services by emphasizing customer satisfaction, continuous improvement, and employee engagement. That's really been the focus of our agency, which is to provide other agencies the best services possible. We primarily do that within this capacity by being good stewards of our facilities. We have made bonding requests in the past, and we'd like to present our six priorities for the 2012. Sorry. I'm going to let Nikki introduce some of the influencing factors on how we came up with our request for this coming bonding session.
Ms. Giancola.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Nikki Giancola with the Department of Administration. What you see here before you are the, we call them influencing factors that we included when we were considering projects for this 2012 capital planning cycle. I just thought, too, that I would give you a little bit of background on the Department of Administration, our role here. The department is responsible for over 4.3 million square feet of space on the Capitol complex. The 22 buildings that we manage include office, warehouse, mail handling and storage space, conference and hearing rooms, food service, and sophisticated lab and data center space. It includes buildings of historic significance, such as this state capitol and the governor's residence, and both are included on the National Register of Historic Places. It also includes the state office building and judicial buildings, which are of historic importance. We also manage ceremonial space and grounds, over 30 distinct parking facilities, as well as the physical plant to support it all. We provide working space for the legislature and judiciary. And approximately 40 state agencies, including numerous boards, councils, and veterans organizations. We serve an average of 7,600 tenants year-round, and that ramps up to about 7,900 during session. Taking care of the facilities at the seat of state government is a unique and awesome responsibility, which we take incredibly seriously. And we take great pride in the reliability and efficiency with which we operate. Our just some recent history for us, we've reduced our operating expenses by over $1 million in the last couple of years, and we've reduced our energy consumption on the Capitol complex by 13.6% in the last fiscal year. And very importantly, we're able to sustain these reductions. We do this by a variety of measures, benchmarking. We follow a sound preventive maintenance program. We have good after-action reporting and good root cause analysis of the events occurring here. We engage professional condition assessments of some of our facilities. We have a very low service-affecting outage rate. We have highly skilled and trained building professionals, and we utilize state-of-the-art automation, energy management, and facility management technology tools. And we use all of this to support our careful and rigorous capital planning process. So these are just a number of the other influencing factors that we use. Our total funding request, maybe next slide, is $32 million for this 2012 cycle. The University Avenue Tunnel at $6.6 million, asset preservation at $21 million, Capitol Campus parking replacement, $900,000, and this is user fees, paid by user fees. The Capital Asset Preservation and Replacement Account, CAPRA, at $2.5 million, and an agency relocation request of $1 million, which would be general fund. I'll quickly go through the five projects. The first one here is the University Avenue Tunnel. This request is to provide for the construction of this segment of the tunnel. This is the piece from the admin building and Lot B to and from the Capitol. And the purpose is to resolve one of the highest security vulnerabilities of the Capitol building, and that being the loading dock and the materials and the receipt of materials and deliveries that's currently right up next to the building. It also resolves accessibility and security deficiencies related to the existing tunnel, and it also supports the Capitol Complex Master Plan strategy in that it provides for the state to implement this one-time opportunity to protect future development options on the property, the state property north of University Avenue. Strong recommendations to complete this work have been given by the National Guard Vulnerability Assessment in 2006, the Committee on Capitol Complex Security, which was established by the governor and leaders from the legislature and Supreme Court, and that report was issued April 1st of last year. And then also the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board issued a resolution passed in June last year strongly recommending tunnel. So it's now time critical. The work must be completed in conjunction with the construction of the Central Corridor Light Rail Transit System. It would be impractical and cost prohibitive to construct it post-CCLRT after the track is placed. Just a note, the track installation is set to begin in April of this year, and it's scheduled to complete in November of this year. And then all of the construction, the track, the road, landscaping, everything is scheduled for completion by fall of 2014 when the line is scheduled to open.
Ms. Giancola, could I just ask, is the location of that tunnel as it is currently, or will it be somewhere else? And I'm not understanding, is there a plan to have a loading dock across the street and then deliver through the tunnel?
Okay. Mr. Chair, this might be a little better, and I know it's a little tough to see, but the existing admin tunnel, as we call it, would remain. That is essentially a utility tunnel today. I mean, I know people use it, but if you've ever been in it, it's really not a pedestrian tunnel. Our utilities are running somewhat exposed down there. It's almost like a rainforest in the spring. It leaks, constant repairs. So that one would stay in place. Our utilities wouldn't move, but this would be an adjacent tunnel to that.
So this is the existing one, and then this would be the new tunnel.
Yeah. We're calling it the North Access Building, but if you're familiar with Lot B, there's kind of a roundhouse there that people enter and get down into the tunnel. That would be expanded a bit to provide for the loading dock and the materials handling and vertical transportation up and down so that it's accessible. It would be separated, one side for materials handling and the other side for public and pedestrians.
Senator Nelson?
Yep, I have two questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you. One on the tunnel. I believe that this tunnel also takes care of those security concerns that were brought forth last year. I think it was in the OLA report. And then I have a larger question. As a longtime member of the Capital Area Architectural Planning Board and a member of the Capital Commission, I'm just curious why you don't have the capital restoration in here. You know, that is a number one thing. It seems like we need to have all of our arrows aligned, and it would. I'm just curious why you don't have that listed here on your priorities.
Senator Nelson, we're going to hear that at some later point. That's a bigger subject than we had time for today.
250.
No, Mr. Chair.
You're talking about the...
I am, and I understand that needs its own hearing. I'm just talking about priorities, and that I would have liked to have seen it on here as one of your funding requests, as one of your priorities. That's all I'm stating.
Yeah. I'm not suggesting... I think we can probably take some of that blame if it doesn't happen to be on the PowerPoint, because we just deferred that project to a later hearing.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, continue on.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And just to answer your question, Senator Nelson, this does resolve numerous of the identified deficiencies that came out of that Capitol Complex security study. We looked at all of that, tunnel being highest priority, but it does move all of that away from the building, and the standoff was one of the biggest vulnerabilities there. So just
thank
sure
you.
Answered that one. Second project is asset preservation for $21 million. Our asset preservation request this year is focused on two buildings, the Capitol and the Centennial Office Building. The specific projects, $13.5 million would be used for the Capitol for stone repairs on the exterior of the building and critical HVAC, electrical, and plumbing repairs that are required of an asset preservation nature. $7.5 million would be directed to the Centennial Office Building to replace the main electrical switch system and the secondary service wiring throughout the building and to replace the transformers and circuit breakers. We consider the COB electrical project urgent. It's our top priority for use of asset preservation funds after the Capitol Building. Any questions about that one?
Just curious, Ms. Giancola,
Are we still living with PCB-contained transformers, or the old oil transformers, or are they dry at this point, generally speaking?
Mr. Chair, good question. I don't know.
That's okay. Don't worry about it.
Okay. We can get back to you.
It's not important.
Our third project is the Capital Campus Parking Replacement Project. This is the user-financed project of $900,000. This request is to provide for pre-design and design for a new multi-level parking ramp to replace surface lot parking of approximately 635 spaces that are currently provided under a lease agreement with Sears. There's been a recent shift in Sears' positioning, indicating that the state's ability to negotiate future extensions to our parking lease are at risk, and this is due principally, we believe, to their interest in having flexibility to pursue development opportunities related to the Central Corridor Light Rail Transit Project. The lease was recently amended to extend the term of the lease for only 2 years. They had previously been giving us five-year lease extensions, and it's at a substantial increase in cost. It's now $29.75 a stall plus $2,700 a month for security, and that's up from $1,775 a stall and $1,700 a month for security. The prospect of losing over 600 spaces without replacement would reduce the inventory of spaces available for contract to approximately 5,200. We do calculate an oversell factor based on the fact that we don't assign specific parking stalls, and so therefore we're able to assign additional contracts over the amount leased. But that would increase it to approximately 5,720, and our current monthly contract volume is 6,432. So there is a need for this. There is a need to pre-plan for this. The current construction estimate for a parking ramp of approximately 400 stalls is about $8 million. And based on preliminary information, it's expected that the site for a new ramp would accommodate those stalls, and we could oversell that to about 477 contracts. But we do need to get going with this one.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Do we know on the replacement ramp, do you have a site picked out yet? Where it would be located?
It's Giancola.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen, not exactly. There are a couple of options for us. One is lot double A. That is the site on the...
That's a battery, isn't it? Double A? Pardon? Oh, okay.
This is the property that's on the, southwest corner of Ryerson University. Currently, it's kind of an L shape. I can't remember how many stalls we have in that lot. But the rest of the property has been taken now by the Met Council for the light rail project, and through an agreement with the state, if it's not needed for anything that they have, it would be transferred, and we could make use of that site.
Chairman, we have to, yes, and I know we have to be very, very careful to protecting the integrity of the campus we have today. I mean, it's beautiful, so, and I'm sure you're going to, but that's very important, of course.
Thank you, members. Any other questions for, I'm sorry, Ms. Giancola, did I cut your presentation off?
And I'll make it real quick. The fourth project is our statewide CAPRA, Capital Asset Preservation and Replacement Account. The purpose of this account, it's really a statewide, enterprise-wide account that admin manages, and it's to support emergency repairs and unanticipated hazardous material abatement needs for state-owned buildings throughout Minnesota. Examples of the use of the CAPRA account are asbestos and lead abatement, emergency pipe, roof leaks, structural repairs, fire, flood, water damage. We report annually on the use of this fund by January 15th. State agencies served in recent years include Admin, PERPICH, Center for Arts, Corrections, DEED, Military Affairs, Human Services, DNR, Veterans Affairs, and the State Academies. And then finally, agency relocation for $1 million, and this is the general fund request. This is another statewide or enterprise-wide account that is managed by admin, and the purpose of this account is to provide for unanticipated or advantageous relocations of state operations. And we believe with everything going on, there is going to be need for access to funds to efficiently relocate, move around people when it's strategic, when it's proven to be cost-effective. In many cases, without access to these funds, people have not made a move that they otherwise could have made and reduced some other cost. But really, because these events are of an unforeseen nature, for which the agency typically hasn't programmed the funds, the lack of access can be a disincentive to doing the right thing. This fund pays for moving furniture, equipment, and communications, and it's also been used to cover the rent differential in the interim when the moves are out of cycle with budgetary situations. The benefits realized from relocations are many. Examples that we've used in the past are when the Department of Employee Relations and Finance merged, we used funds to get them together in one location. We used it to consolidate and co-locate our risk management division with the workers' comp division. And then we've used it at various times in the Veterans Service Building to move those organizations around. The account has been drained for a number of years. There is essentially nothing there. When we work with folks today and they do make a move, it's coming out of their operating funds. So having access to this kind of funding is essential to make these strategic moves in an efficient manner.
Okay. Senator Carlson. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I almost said Senator Paul Bunyan.
Just a quick question, Ms. Giancola. I'm confused a little bit. You say $1 million from the general fund, but we're talking about a bonding bill. Are you suggesting that we take $1 million, bond for it for 20 years for something that... I need to have someone kind of explain that to me.
No, it is, Mr. Chair and Senator, it is general fund. It isn't bond funds. I don't believe these kinds of moves and expenses are eligible for bond funding, but they are typically requested in the bonding cycle. We have done that along with bond cycle years. I honestly don't know why that convention, but it's requested in the bonding cycle.
It's cash. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Higgins.
It's not uncommon that we do this, and maybe Senator Langseth can give us some history because he's been doing it for a lot of years, having actual cash in the bonding bill for some projects like this that don't fit the criteria of the bonding but are, you know, so related to the work that's being done through the bonding bill that we put cash toward it as well, and it just carries in the bonding bill.
Senator Langseth, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Last year, I think we were told that there shouldn't be any cash in the bonding bill, and I think that was because of our dire straits with general fund money. But it is very common for us to have some cash money for capital expenditures in the bonding bill. And if something doesn't last for 20 years, so usually it's not bondable unless it's part of a much larger project.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Langseth. Thank you, Commissioner and Ms. Giancola. Members, if you have any other further questions, we'd encourage you to contact the Commissioner's office directly. I myself have had a number of correspondence with Commissioner Kronk, and I'm grateful for your responsiveness, and I'm sure you would experience the same thing if you have a question for him. Thank you
appreciate
for coming
it.
To the
Thank
committee
you.
Today. Next, we have Mr. Lee Emke and Ms. Peggy Edelman from the Minnesota Zoological Gardens. Mr. Emke, welcome to the committee. We have everything set there on a technical side.
We're working on it here. Okay. It looks like it's going to take a while to warm up. Thank you, Chair Pedersen and members of the committee. I'm Lee Emke. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Zoo, and with me is Peggy Adelman, the chief financial officer for the zoo. What I was hoping to present, and maybe it'll pop up here in a minute, was just a little bit of background on the zoo, which, as you all should know and do know, is a state agency, although we're a state agency with a difference in that our mission is focused around wildlife and wildlife conservation and education surrounding that. So,
Mr. Emke, we are going to check on the technical aspects there, so be assured we're going to work on that for you while you're talking here.
Thank you. Our request today is actually a two-part request. It's both for new capital improvements at the zoo, but the primary focus and the majority of the request is for asset preservation and exhibit renewal. Our initial request totaled $35 million. $5 million of that is for capital improvements as part of our master plan. The $30 million is for asset preservation and exhibit renewal. I do believe you have a handout, which you should have all received, which goes through the both, I guess, the underlying rationale for the request as well as the specific items that are included within it. The asset preservation request, again, is our top priority. We're a zoo that's now more than 35 years old. We have buildings that are, in some cases, 40 years old and are in need of significant upgrade and repair. The top priority, and it looks like maybe we're getting close here. No. Okay. our very top priority within the asset preservation request is for repairs to our Discovery Bay exhibit. Discovery Bay, as you all know, is a 15-year-old facility with featuring marine mammals, sharks, and other aquatic animals. We've noticed in recent years some significant degradation of the waterproofing system of the main pool that houses our marine mammals. And we are in a situation where it's not an emergency, but we want to exercise due diligence and make those repairs now before it becomes an emergency situation. I do have, in lieu of a PowerPoint, a physical exhibit. Normally when we come here, we like to bring animals and talk a little bit about the collection that we have. In this case, given our focus on physical facilities, my exhibit's a little less exciting. But this is actually a piece of the pool liner from our dolphin pool that my marine mammal staff brought to my office yesterday morning. They found it floating in the pool, and this is typical of the kind of degradation that we're seeing. What you're looking at is an epoxy coating that basically lines the pool and is the primary waterproofing element within it, and you can see the rust spots. What that's telling us is that salt water, which is very corrosive by its nature, is getting into and behind this waterproofing layer into the steel that's structurally supporting the pool. Corrosion's occurring, and it's starting to pop the liner off. So we're in a situation where this needs to be addressed. At this point, it's not an animal health issue. It's simply a kind of a mechanical and structural issue. As a licensed exhibitor of animals, the U.S. Department of Agriculture actually provides us with a license to exhibit our animals to the public. And we've been put on notice that situations like this, peeling paint in general, but especially in a marine mammal facility, is an opportunity for them to look very hard at our licensure, and we don't want to ever get to that situation. So our proposal right now is to move our animals to another facility and do the heavy lifting required to make these repairs. It's both a waterproofing issue within the pool, but we're also seeing some structural damage potentially to the columns that support the building. All of this is something we want to take care of immediately and is, again, the top priority within our asset preservation request. Now that we've got the audio visuals up, I just wanted to kind of jump back to a little bit of the background about our zoo. Our mission is to connect people, animals, and nature. We do that in a lot of different ways, but one of the key points, I think, for all of you to know is that although we're located in Apple Valley here in the Twin Cities, we do serve the entire state through our education programs, which take, through our Zoomobile, takes animals and educators out to the entire state. We're also visited by guests from the entire state and have members of the zoo represented in almost every county in the state. Let's see if this is going to... Sure why this isn't going here, folks.
Mr. Emke, I'm told that the arrow is at the top of the screen. We'll accomplish what you...
Top of the screen. Okay, great. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, our committee administrator. Save the day again. Mr. Emke.
Again, as part of the background, we are a state agency, but you can see that over the years we've moved from being primarily reliant on the state for operating support to primarily self-sufficient. With the most recent reductions to our general fund appropriation, we're now down to 25% of our total budget of about $21 million coming from the state. The rest we're earning or is coming to the zoo in terms of as contributions to our foundation. We've developed a very strong public-private partnership at the zoo with many of these companies and many more now actively participating in supporting the zoo, both our operational budgets as well as the capital projects that we have at the zoo. And all of that is adds up to a pretty major impact that we make on the state. A study was done, this is now actually 3 years old, but the economic impact of operating the zoo currently, the jobs that were created and the indirect benefits total over $114 million a year. And I would add this does not include the impact that's gained by capital construction projects at the zoo, of which there have been many. But I think the key to how the zoo has actually succeeded and thrived despite the reduced operating support from the state, the key to that has been the capital investment and reinvestment in our facilities, again, through the private sector, but also as a result of significant bonding support that we've received over the last several years. I can't emphasize enough the importance of the reinvention of the zoo as a way to attract new guests and attract interest in the zoo, and I want to thank this committee, the legislature, for the past support for zoo, which has been terrific. The kinds of renewal that we've done at the zoo are really in two different categories. One is asset preservation and exhibit renewal. This is an example of that, our Minnesota Trail that was rebuilt back in 2007. Existing exhibit redone in a way that basically created a new experience for our guests and became one of the most popular exhibits at the zoo. We also have major new master, what we call master plan projects, the most significant of which was the Russia's Grizzly Coast environment that opened in 2008, which really did signal kind of a new, new threshold for the zoo for attendance and public visibility. And as you can see here, the numbers, the last 4 years, including the year we're in right now, will be the best 4 years in the history of the zoo in terms of attendance, which is obviously one of those metrics that we look at very closely to see, you know, are things working. So the capital reinvestment in the zoo has added up to real success in terms of bringing people to the zoo, generating more revenue for the zoo, and allowing us to do more of the conservation and education work that's really at the core of what we do. So this year, our capital budget request, again, I mentioned it earlier, was $30 million for asset preservation and exhibit renewal, and $5 million to continue the Heart of the Zoo master plan. The question's been asked by a number of people why the asset preservation request is so large this year, and this chart gives you a little bit of a sense of why that's the case. Over the last 7 or 8 years, we've made significant requests based on our top priorities for asset preservation, and although we have had some significant appropriations during that time, about $21 million, we have not received nearly the amount that we believe was necessary to keep up with the asset preservation needs at the zoo. So this year we're essentially asking for catching up to the fact that we have these unmet needs. And again, the facility, much of it is now approaching 40 years in age. The bills that have been introduced to date do not go all the way to our request, but they're, I believe, both in the House and the Senate. We have $15 million for asset preservation, $5 million for the master plan. The governor's recommendation was for $7 million for asset preservation with a specific focus on the dolphin tank in Discovery Bay. The exhibit renewal priorities in our request, the Discovery Bay is the very top of the list, but we have other older exhibits that really do need to be upgraded and refreshed that we would hope to get to as well, the Northern Trail and our Tropics National Hallway. But coming back again to our top priority, Discovery Bay, it's one of the attendance drivers at the zoo. It is a facility that generates revenue through special events and education activities. It's really a core piece of our zoo. And as I've mentioned, we're seeing some degradation. It's kind of typical with saltwater environments and saltwater exhibits. The life cycle is typically about 15 to 20 years. A very similar facility at the Brookfield Zoo in Chicago recently underwent exactly the same kind of repair and renewal that we're looking to do here. And in case you're wondering, while they were doing their repairs, all of their animals came to our zoo, and we hosted them for about 9 months while the construction went on. And we would be doing a similar thing with our animal collection when this work begins. In addition to the pool integrity, we're also looking at the saltwater intrusion on things like the guest seating areas. The mechanical systems that provide air throughout the building are also sensitive to saltwater and need some significant renovation at the same time. So this is our very top priority in the request. But beyond that, we have a long list that is prioritized in the information that you've received for other infrastructure upgrades and repairs at the zoo, ranging from skylight and roof replacements, insulating old pipes, repairing asphalt. The list is quite extensive, and again, we will adjust our priorities depending on the eventual size of the overall appropriation, but we have no shortage of needs in this area. This is just one example. The lower plaza outside of our main building seems to be tilting into our main lake, and we obviously need to address that as both a public safety issue. It's not just aesthetics. This is about taking care of some pretty significant infrastructure problems at the zoo.
Mr. Emke, can I interrupt you for a second? I just wanted to double-check how much of your presentation you have left. We're kind of moving up against our deadline, and just want to double-check if we have questions as well. How much more time do you have left?
I'll move through it in 1 minute here.
Okay, thank you.
The other section of our request is for master plan to continue the master plan work that we've been doing at the zoo. We completed phase one this past summer, replaced our old entrance with a beautiful new entrance that eventually will serve guests coming in groups and our school groups. We built a new education center as part of that entry, new education spaces, using sustainable building design wherever possible. A major new public facility is a penguin exhibit that was part of phase one of Heart of the Zoo. And we took an old piece of our infrastructure, our old abandoned whale pool, and converted that into a beautiful new indoor theater and education space with the help, again, of the state legislature and Target. Our $5 million request this year would be to continue the Heart of the Zoo project to build an upper-level single point of entry serving our growing audience, building new exhibits as soon as you arrive at the zoo featuring prairie environments and prairie wildlife. We're very excited right now to be entering into a partnership with the DNR to begin breeding bison with the idea of reintroducing them to state parks where they used to be found but aren't currently. And this new facility would allow us to really move with that project. And our old snow monkey exhibit, which is one of the kind of relics of the 70s, would be part of the Heart of the Zoo Phase 2 project that the $5 million request would help move along. So, again, our goal with the zoo is to become one of the world leaders in exhibition, education, and conservation. The physical facilities are obviously key to that. We thank the legislature for the support we've received in the past and look forward to continuing to work with you to give the Minnesotans the great zoo that everyone expects and deserves. So with that, thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Emke. I apologize for having to rush you through your presentation. We just have to leave ample time for the next committee to get set up here as well. So members, is there any questions for Mr. Emke? Thank you. Looks like you covered it. Thanks for your presentation. With that, members, we just have a quick reminder for you that any of the presentations, PowerPoint presentations that you saw today are linked on the committee's agenda on our committee webpage. If you want copies of those for any reasons, please, we would encourage you to contact those folks directly from your office. Our next committee meeting is Monday, February 27th at 6 p.m. In this room. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.